May it please the court, my name is Jim Birch, registration number 15899. Don Ostrander is seated at council table. We represent the appellants, the two auditorial entities in this case. Given the number of issues on appeal and cross appeal and the constraints on time and arguing, I'd like to focus first on areas where there might be an overlap of the appeal and cross appeal. I'd like to talk about the nature and scope of the taking, and at one point at least where the experts on both sides agree. In this case, there was an actual taking, and there seems to be a little bit of dispute between the parties as to exactly what the scope of that taking was, but the taking began as a permanent total take in fee simple. That's what the district asked for when it filed its condemnation petition in March of 2008, and that's what the district told the world it was taking when it recorded its list pendants in April of 2008. And it was still a permanent total taking in fee simple when the district obtained its stipulated order of possession in June of 2008. And the list pendants, which advised, told the world that this was a permanent total taking, remained in place until the following year, until May of 2009. What was the effect of the list pendants? This is an area where we have, it's a rare thing, at least in my experience, where experts on both sides agree. Even the district's appraiser agreed that because of the district's condemnation list pendants, Auditorial lost the right and the ability to sell or lease the property.
Don't people do that all the time? Don't people sell properties that have a list pendants on them? Can't you bond around them? Can't you get someone to, if you pay them off, go away? Go ahead.
They may do that all the time outside a condemnation context. And that's essentially what the district's appraiser said. He said, I don't know about other cases. And I don't even know about other cases in eminent domain, but this case and these facts are unusual. And he said that this is unique, and under these facts and under this condemnation list pendants, no, you cannot sell this property.
Where is that testimony?
It is in the record on the CD at pages 1796 and 1797. And of course, the Auditorial's appraiser agreed as well that you could not sell this property due to the condemnation list pendants, CD page 1630. What flows from this are several things. First, I'd like to talk about why the landowner should recover on the diminution in value claim and the cutoff date for damages. What should, we believe, be a bright line rule would be when the list pendants is released, and that the landowner should be paid fair rental that takes into account the inability to rent out the property, which is what the district's appraiser testified to. On the diminution in value claim, there are several points. First, under the eminent domain law, the condominium must pay for what the landowner lost. That's the Fowler case.
It's a remainder property situation, and that's not exactly what we have here, is it?
It is, Your Honor, in that initially, the way the condemnation began, there was no remainder. It was a total take. There was no remaining property.
I think you told us that about 5 minutes ago very emphatically.
Yes. And then, and then due to the abandonment, due to the decision by the district to abandon, there became a remainder. They're no longer taking any of the property. When they're all done, all of the property goes back to the landowner. And the landowner gets back a property that has less value than when it was taken.
Classic case like Fowler, where you have what we would typically call remainder property, parcel A, parcel B. The damages to parcel B are caused by the condemnation of parcel A. Example, they put up a sewage plant or something. Now B isn't worth as much.
That's right.
Okay. But therefore, the diminution of value to B is clearly caused by the condemnation. But was the diminution of value to Auditorial's property here caused by the condemnation, or was it caused by the fact that real estate prices happened to fall in 2008?
Auto Trail suffered damage as a result of being unable to sell their property during that declining market. It's true the market caused a decline in values, but Auto Trail suffered a damage as a result of being forced out of the market and frozen out of the market. And there is a line of authority, Your Honor, and we cited that. We cited a couple of cases, but there are many, many cases going back to the 1800s in Colorado on that line of authority, and that is that the landowner is entitled to all damages that are a natural result of the taking. And we believe that with the testimony of the district's own expert that this list pendants, as a result of this last pendants, the landowner lost the right and the ability to sell the property. We believe that that testimony provides the link that this was a natural, that this loss and this diminution in value was a natural result of this taking.
This is the testimony of the appraiser you're referring to.
That's correct.
Not the testimony of the broker who wasn't able to testify.
We're talking about that's correct. We're talking about, even before we get to that question, we're talking about the district's own appraiser. There's another line of authority that says the landowner in an eminent domain case should be placed in the same pecuniary position as before the taking. Again, it is undisputed here that the district gave back property that was worth substantially less than when they initiated the taking.
Not caused by the taking, but caused by the fall of market value. I mean, there is no case exactly like this that I've read that says when there's a fall in market value that happens to coincide with a taking that prohibits the owner from selling, the owner's entitled to the damages for the fall in market value.
That's correct.
There is no case like that.
That's correct. The closest we came was that case we cited. We cited three landowner cases, and it was the last of the three from the 1890s. 1893, and that really, we admit that's dictum. The case talked about if there's a diminution in value during the eminent domain proceeding, that it may be that the landowner would be denied just compensation if they're not paid for that diminution in value. But in that case, the landowner waived that argument by accepting the lower value, accepting there were two different dates that they could have done that. So, no, that's as close as we come, is a hint from the Supreme Court that would be an infringement of a fundamental right, which is in the Bill of Rights, the right to just compensation for a taking of property.
Neither side on this issue really cites any outside Colorado authority. I recognize there are some. Are you aware of any outside of Colorado?
I'm not aware of any authority, Your Honor.
Mr. Burtz, I'm looking at the record sites that you've just given me. This appears to be the valuation hearing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So this testimony that you just cited to me was not presented to the trial court at the time period when you were supposed to be proving causation. Is that right?
Well, the trial court invited us to come back. We had a hearing about the cutoff date for damages and how to prove damages, and the trial court said what you need to do is come forward with a ready, willing, and able buyer. We went back with a motion to reconsider to cover an item that we thought was covered at the hearing, but the hearing wasn't recorded, which was that we had a broker available to say, who testified that there's a reason.
Counsel, my question is really simple. The testimony that you're citing to me was not given before the judge.
That's correct.
That's all I was asking.
It was not. The judge invited us to come back with additional arguments, but we got the picture when he denied the motion to reconsider, and we didn't go back with that one more time and ask him, consider this as well. He denied the motion to reconsider and essentially said he was standing by his original ruling. And his original ruling, as the briefing on the motion to reconsider sets forth pretty clearly, briefing on both sides, his original ruling was, you must come to me with a ready, willing, and able buyer for a sum certain on a date certain. That's what you need. And we didn't have that. That's why we didn't go back when we got this testimony. That's why we didn't go back to the judge and say, here's one more thing. I'm just bringing this up in the interest of judicial economy. It will save time and in the interest of fundamental fairness. I noticed in going back over the briefing Something jumped out at me where the district said the inability, in its brief here in this court, district said the inability to sell the property cannot be linked in any way to the district to the district's condemnation. But we believe that this testimony of the district's own appraiser links it, and we believe that the testimony we intended to offer on reasonable probability that you could sell the property links that as well.
Now, Counselor, I just want to be a little bit clearer here, because we do have a lot of law out there that says that an issue that's raised for the first time in oral argument is not necessarily to be considered by the panel. Is this issue that you're just telling us about, where this testimony came up, was that raised in your briefs? Because I don't recall seeing it.
We cited that in the briefing. We did cite in the briefing, and we, I don't know that we quoted, but we cited and said that the district's own appraiser found that the property was unmarketable. It could not be marketed, could not be sold as a result of the district's condemnation. This pins. We said it two or three times in the briefing.
But what you're saying now is that missing link of causation that Judge Phelps found absent before the commission hearing, before the jury trial, was only supplied at the jury trial. And you didn't ask him to reconsider a second time.
Well, we're saying we supplied several of those. One was we offered testimony on reasonable probability from a broker that it's reasonably probable that this property would have sold had the condemnation not been in place, which is substantially similar. We're just saying if you look hard enough, you'll see that there wouldn't be any disagreement as to this in the community of real estate appraisers. They would agree that this case is unique and you could not sell this property because of the condemnation.
Before you go forward, I have a specific question about the period of damages.
Yes.
My understanding is your claim is that the period of damage should have continued until, I think it's May of 2009 when the Liz Pendant was finally released.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he cut it off in September.
Right.
Did the period of possession end in September? Or how do we determine when the period of possession ended? Because isn't that all that you're entitled to compensation for in terms of the lease value?
Two things, Your Honor. First, it's not clear exactly when the period of possession ended. Probably ended sometime around the time that the district filed its notice of election to abandon. They probably ended their physical possession at that point. But the first thing is that the Fowler case says that the taking ends when the landowner's legal interest and occupation of the property is reestablished. Autotrail's legal interest was not reestablished until the Liz Pendant was released in May of 2009. But because they were unable to sell it, because the Liz Pendant advised the world that this property was being condemned. Now, the district...
That may have affected some practical interest that they had, but it didn't affect their legal interest. They still owned the property, right?
They owned the property, but they were unable... It affected their legal interest in the sense that their legal right to sell the property was impacted. They couldn't sell the property because the Liz Pendant remained on it, and any buyers would be dissuaded.
But the Liz Pendant was only on there, because of inadvertence. So if someone had come along, they could have said, "Oh, hey guys, take that Liz Pendant off, because now we have a stuff."
They wouldn't look any further. I mean, if you send it back, we can certainly. This is common in the eminent domain field, we believe. They don't look any further. When they see an eminent domain Liz Pendant, that's different. That says we're exercising our power of eminent domain. We're taking this property. The buyer stops looking at that point.
I don't know of any buyers who look for Liz Pendant before they decide whether they're going to make an offer.
Well, that's a factual question. You want to send it back? That hasn't been decided here. But I think that you'll find, if you look at the testimony, you'll find that the appraisers regard it that way. That's how the appraisers regarded it in this case. I'd like to reserve, if there are no further questions, reserve what time I have for rebuttal.
Just a little less than a minute.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Jody Alderman, registration number 24450, and with me at council table is Carrie Bernstein, of the firm of Alderman Bernstein. We represent the school district, Adams 12 five-star schools. I think it's important to point out in some of the discussion with Mr. Birch that in every condemnation case that's filed, a list pendens is recorded. It's like any other real property case. If there's a matter that could affect title to real property, a list pendens is recorded. So the natural extension of Otter Trail's argument here, if they were successful, would mean that in every case where a condemnor begins a condemnation and then subsequently exercises its right to abandon, which it has under Colorado law, in a declining market, the landowner would get the difference in value from the date of possession to the date of abandonment. That would, it would be like a per se damages, which is not consistent with the law we have in Colorado. The trial court based
the law is it not consistent with? Do you know of a case that says you can't get damage for this?
Not specific to an abandonment scenario, but the Yago versus E470 case, which is what the trial court relied on, has an entire section on causation that requires that link to be made. So in this situation, and you know, the other thing to point out is there was never any evidence offered that in fact the market declined in June to August of 2008, which is when the temporary possession occurred, and there was no evidence offered of this diminishment in value because obviously it didn't get to the commission. So there's nothing in the record on that. But Otto Troll, of course, claims that there was some diminishment in value that it wanted to present, but was not permitted to. And as I mentioned, the Yago case is the dispositive case on that, I think, in these proceedings, because it's not enough to simply have valuation evidence that shows there was a change in value in two time periods. You must have that link, that causation, to show that the condemnation itself, or perhaps the project that's constructed on the property that's taken, somehow diminishes the value of the remainder property.
So if this broker, who wasn't permitted to testify, had testified that the Liz pendants precluded sale during that period, or the condemnation pendency precluded sale, would that be the link?
If there was evidence that the condemnation and the recorded list pendants prevented a sale, yes. I think it's similar to a slander of title or malicious prosecution case when you have a list pendants recorded. If you can show that you've lost a buyer because of the actions of, in this case, the school district, then that would be the link, and that's what the trial court was looking for.
Actual buyer or hypothetical buyer? I don't think the broker is going to say there was an actual buyer. He's going to say it just wasn't possible. My understanding, he wasn't possible to sell a property while the Liz pendens was on record. That's what I understand, Mr. The counsel to say.
And I think that has been their argument throughout, is relying on the Hewitt v. Rice case and that statement in the case that says the Liz pendens renders property unmarketable. They're relying on that to say, well, then they couldn't have sold it. But no, the evidence the trial court required was something more than that, because even if the Liz pendens is sitting there, if there wasn't any buyer or contract on the property, then there hasn't been any damage suffered. The Liz pendens was just there for that period of time and then removed.
So if there was an actual buyer introduced, here's a person ready, willing, and able to buy, then they could recover their damages?
Well, I think that's precisely an example of the type of evidence that would be causation evidence to say that a Liz pendens caused a decline in the value of the property.
Caused a decline in the value of the property, caused a lost sale opportunity. The Liz pendens didn't, he concedes it didn't cause a decline in the value of the property.
The market caused the decline, you're correct, Your Honor, but the difference in value, the difference between the value on the date of possession versus the value on the date of abandonment, X minus Y becomes Otter Troll's amount they're claiming. So if somebody would have purchased it on the date of possession but didn't because of the condemnation, then that's, they did lose that difference in value.
But for the presence of a buyer, they don't get their damages that they're seeking.
That's the only kind of evidence I can think of that would be that causation link, or if they had a contract prior to the condemnation case being filed. That would be another, I think, example of the type of evidence that could come in on that point. There is an argument, well, there's two arguments of Otter Troll on appeal. The one is that they should be permitted to recover the per se damages, the difference in value on those two dates, without causation evidence. The other argument they've made is that they should be allowed to present evidence of a reasonable probability that the property would have been sold. And in this situation, the trial court never reached that issue because there was no evidence presented to which it applied an admissibility standard. On the motion to reconsider, There was a statement made by Auto Troll that it believed its broker would be able to testify that it probably would have sold but for the condemnation, but there were no affidavits, there were no expert reports, there was never even an offer of proof from Auto Troll during the hearing to which the trial court could actually react and apply a standard of admissibility, such as reasonable probability.
Broker
Yes. Yes, and in fact, that point was made when we argued the motion to reconsider and in our briefing to you. The broker was listed as a will call witness at that damages hearing on causation, but he did not testify. He had an expert opinion. He was deposed, all in preparation of these proceedings, but was never offered or called as a witness. So, and it was the same broker. The reasonable probability standard, I won't spend too much time on that unless the court has questions, but reasonable probability is really a limited kind of admissibility standard in condemnation cases. It is applied only in situations where there's a question of whether a property could be rezoned and used for a higher and better use in terms of considering valuation. And those are all the cases that were cited to you in the briefing related to reasonable probability. In terms of the issues we have before the court on estoppel, one issue on cross appeal is the district's issue that Auto Troll Technology should not have been permitted to intervene back into the case at the estoppel hearing. This is not an issue the court needs to reach unless somehow the case is remanded for a new estoppel hearing, but it's briefed for you, and Auto Troll Technology was the original owner of the property. It sold it to Auto Troll Real Estate and substituted itself out of the case as a party. And in that substitution, it made the statement that it had no further interest in the property. And at that point was leasing the property with a lease that was scheduled to end on the date the district was scheduled to take possession of the balance of the building. So we argued right at the beginning of the estoppel hearing whether or not Auto Troll Technology should be able to testify as to acts it may have taken in reliance on the condemnation. And the trial court did permit Auto Troll to intervene, and that point is before the court on the district's cross appeal.
Well, as long as we're talking about your cross appeal, counsel, let's, as I understand it, you have three issues on cross appeal.
Yes.
And am I correct in saying that only one of them needs to be addressed if there's an affirmance, and the other two need to be addressed if there's a reversal?
Is
that correct?
Okay. Go ahead.
And the one that needs to be addressed if there's, regardless, is which one?
Is the one related to the cutoff date, which was the last conversation you had with Mr. Birch, and that relates to when does the abandonment become effective. And we don't have a procedural rule in Colorado, and the abandonment cases we do have are very explicit in saying that the condemnor can abandon a condemnation at any time. It's a right, it's described as a right and a privilege. So it is our position that upon giving notice of abandonment, then the condemnation case ceases. Now, of course, the trial court still has other things to deal with in terms of costs and damages resulting from the abandonment, but the fact of the condemnation case ceases on that date, which would be August 21st, 2008.
The condemnation case doesn't cease. As it just turned, still got to be a trial. It's an overstatement.
I misspoke. And you're not the case that ceases, but the act of condemning the property at that point ceases. That possession ends, and now we're going forward and dealing with issues related to the period of possession that has ended.
How do we know the
possession? Yeah.
For example, did it in the record possession ended the day that the notice got sent?
Well, in this situation, the school district had possession under the immediate possession order for 29,000 square feet. 19,000 square feet was occupied by a subtenant of Autotrola Church. They never left. They were there the whole time. The 10,000 square feet, the school district had planned to do some early childhood development construction in, but never began that construction. There was no physical change to the property. So the school district was never physically in the property. In condemnation, the right to possession arises when the deposit is made in court. And at that point, the landowner has the opportunity under statute to withdraw 3/4 of that deposit. So, what the trial court said is, well, once that deposit came back into court, that statutory right to possession ceased, and that date was September 9th, 2008. Well, I mean, I think it makes sense under this notion of deposit, but I think the difference is once it was deposited back in, that landowner didn't have the right to withdraw it, which is part and parcel to this right to possession. So the money's in court. But at that point, once it was redeposited, the landowner couldn't take it back out. So I think under the cases we have that say the condemnor has the right to abandon indicate that it's a notice process or an election process of the condemnor and not something the court has to approve. And then to your point, the other issues related to the area of the taking would only be something the court would have to address if the damages hearing was remanded. And the intervention question would only be addressed if the estoppel claims were remanded. I'd like to go back to the estoppel issues that the court has before it. Autotrol has argued that the trial court applied the wrong legal standard in determining or denying the estoppel claim. And I think if you read the order closely, the court looked at PIS, and that's the leading, you know, Supreme Court case on what are the elements of estoppel, and looked at all of those elements and made findings to deny estoppel based on PIS. This case is very different from PIS. I mean, in that case, the landowner was a bakery owner. He had all the special equipment that he couldn't move and had to rely on the fact of condemnation to go build a new bakery. In this case, Autotrol never left the building, so to speak. It had started to pack and started to negotiate a lease, but it had never physically moved from the building, and it had never had a valid lease in place by the time the abandonment occurred. If I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for my cross appeal. Am I permitted to do that? Yes, thank you.
Just on the cross.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. The broker was not called as a witness at trial because the trial court had ruled that his testimony was insufficient, that what you needed was a ready, willing, and able buyer. Yagow does not address our problem. I'm fully aware of Yagow. I argued that case in the Colorado Supreme Court on behalf of the E-470, and Yagow did not involve a condemnation list pendants, and it did not address the line of authority that says the landowner must be put in the same pecuniary position as prior to the taking. The district is correct that the reasonable probability standard has not been applied to whether a particular property would or would not sell in an eminent domain case, and that's because the standard has always been an eminent domain, that you look at what a hypothetical buyer would do. You assume a willing buyer in the marketplace. We've cited the Polizzi case. You assume a willing buyer, and the similar line of authority regarding a fair rental, the Fowler case, says you assume a willing tenant, and you proceed from that. That's how you compensate landowners in eminent domain cases. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question before we start the clock? Is there a transcript of the September 9th hearing?
No.
Okay.
The only issue I didn't touch on in terms of cross appeal was related to the take area or what the district is required to pay fair market rent for if the damages hearing, the damages proceeding was remanded, then the trial court erred in not defining the area of the take. The stipulation for possession is in the record. It's quite detailed. It sets out the exact areas in the building that the school district could go into and use. The balance of the building, approximately 100,000 square feet, that Autotrol was permitted to continue to use, including any parking related to it and so forth. So it's a very detailed possession order, and what was asked of the trial court was to direct the commission or instruct the commission on the area of the take. Under 38.1.102.2a in the Colorado statutes, the only thing the commission is supposed to be listening to is valuation evidence and deciding. Everything else, the court must decide. So the court should have directed the commission on what the area of the take was based on an interpretation of the stipulation for possession. That was the last thing I needed to cover, and I think we've...
What impact did that have?
Well, what impact that had was the difference between the school district's appraiser, who testified that rent on that 29,000 square feet was about $70,000, and Autotrol's appraiser testified to rent on the whole building of $350,000, and the award came back at $333,755. So it was, there was an impact. Thank you.
This is highly unusual, and I apologize, but this seemed like new argument that I've not had an opportunity to respond to. And it was not something that was addressed, but I didn't address it in my rebuttal.
Let us take a look at that, and if we decide we need further briefing, we'll let you
know. Thank you, Your Honor. I only raise it because I felt new argument had been raised in the reply brief, and there are some facts that have not been yet disclosed to the court.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.